Welcome to the Calgary Sessions. This is episode number 90, which is a crazy number for me to say out loud. I'm your host, Jeff Humphreys. Today's guest, him and I go back to a time on 17th Ave. This is like in the 90s, same high school, year apart, knew of each other, just around the same people. Our good friend, the Turbides, they're the ones that are like, you got to talk to him. You got to get him on. I'm like, fuck yeah. So anyways, here we are. So please introduce yourself, name and who you are.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Jeff. Nice to be here. My name's Matt Masters Bergener and I'm a music worker.
Music worker.
That's what I do. I work in music.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. I've had a few musicians on the show mm-hmm. and it's very interesting hearing how they describe themselves.
Music's a weird industry. You know, like if you probably had a few like people from other industries also on the show, but they probably have a bit more like of a defined way of defining themselves. Like mm-hmm. if you're an entrepreneur, you'll be like, I'm a C-suite entrepreneur or I'm a tech company entrepreneur, which I also am, but I'm a music worker. You know, like some musicians are like, I play guitar in studios. Some musicians are like, I play drums in a jazz band every week. You know, other musicians are therapists, other musicians are educators. Mm-hmm. Music's such a diverse industry, you know, and I do a lot of things. And so music worker is a good kind of catch-all. Mm-hmm. It also is a good way to kind of tear down the stereotypes around what music is.
Yeah,
because music is work and it's not always seen that way. Mm-hmm. But if we self-define as music workers, then it's easier to talk about it as work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating. How many years has it taken you to get to that point where you can say it so clearly and authentically?
Yeah. I mean, I have been a full-time music worker since 2002.
Yeah.
So 21 years. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like that's according to my tax returns. And then before that, you know, I spent a couple of years as like essentially an amateur musician mm-hmm. where I was gigging, but not living off it.
Yeah.
Which for me is like, that's the distinction between amateur and professional,
yep.
you know? Music's been, you know, part of my story since I was like a kid, mm-hmm. but more seriously, you know, since like my mid-20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. This is going to be a fun one for me. I think our brothers hung out with each other growing up. I've heard your name over all these years
yeah.
in different places.
Yeah.
You know, I was working in nightclubs for a long time and you were playing live gigs all the time.
Yeah.
Like, so I've heard your name for all these years, like, cover magazines. Like, so this will be a cool one for me to just like sit back and enjoy these memories with you. Cause I think it's going to be awesome. So
cool, man. I'm a Calgary guy. And like, yeah. That's, you know, one of the things I'm thinking about coming into this show is just about, you know, where I've come from and where I am, where my kids are going, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So this would be a cool one. You've seen a couple of them.
Yeah.
So yeah, take it back as far as you want to go. I want you to go back to a point where like, you know, how you grew up. I know where you grew up. So not everyone does. And you know, what your inspiration was, you know, how music started,
sure.
you know, your first musical memory. So just take it back and we'll just kind of weave a story to where you are today.
Well, we're sitting here at 17th Avenue and 2nd Street. So I grew up 21 blocks that way. I grew up a few blocks off 17th, you know,
yep.
On this side of Crowchild Trail, a neighborhood called Scarborough. Mm-hmm. Moved to town when I was a newborn from Saskatchewan. I was born in North Battleford
okay.
and grew up here in Calgary. I have three siblings and my folks were here in Calgary. And you know what? I'm a person of privilege. That's how I kind of see myself. That's the first way I describe myself because my parents loved me and supported me in my you know, ambitions. And they were both hardworking, well-to-do people. You know, my dad was a senior architect in the city. My mom was a, you know, politician for 16 years, successful politician. So my parents were like part of the city scene. Mm-hmm. And that presented me with opportunities that have really helped me. So I like to recognize that at the start of any kind of introduction to who I am.
Yep.
I'm a Calgary guy who grew up off 17th Ave. You know, I went to St. Mary's High School just off 17th Avenue. I cut my teeth playing music, you know, at the Ship and Anchor, at the Night Gallery, at the Republic, you know, all on and off 17th Avenue. Mm-hmm. At this point, I've traveled all over the world playing music. Like I say, I've been doing it full time since I was about 25 and I'm 47. Yeah. And like I use the word music worker to describe myself because I have spent time in so many places. You know, I'm a performer and I'm a singer and a guitar player. I'm a songwriter. I've also worked in the administrative side of music. You know, I spent some time in Toronto working as a general manager of a not-for-profit, the Toronto Blues Society, back like 20 years ago. Crazy. I worked for the City of Calgary, helping draft the bylaw for busking. You know, I worked for the National Music Center for a couple of years in advocacy with a thing called Music Cities, trying to talk about the economic impact of music, you know. So I've run festivals, I've booked nightclubs, you know, and so all those things just kind of compile to a career in music.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, and then like, that's my music story, you know, but for me, it's also a community story.
Yeah.
And for me, those two things are kind of, they're part of the same story.
Yeah.
You know, for me, being from this community, and it's funny how like central it is to 17th Avenue.
It's so weird that we're sitting on like you, like this stretch of the city, the 17th Ave, I don't know how many hours you spend here going up and down it and like all the different places and all like
totally
going to school. And here we are, like of all the places to sit down and do this.
But you know, that's kind of the maturing of a city.
Yeah.
Is when a community is big enough that you can spend your life in it.
Yeah.
I've lived in other cities and I've traveled all over the world, but this is where my home is. You know, this is the area I grew up in. I'm really comfortable in this space. My wife grew up across the river, you know, she grew up in Crescent Heights and like,
different.
You know, just ever so slightly different.
Yeah.
You know, this is my home. My kids were born in this area. You know, like I've lived all around, you know, the Beltline, the Mission, you know, like kind of moved around a little bit, Ramsey and Bridgeland too, but like, when we were having our third kid and needed to find a few more, like an extra two bedrooms, we found a spot in Glendale, which is really nice for us. But yeah, it's like I have spent most of my life in and around this street and like the 45 blocks roughly of it that I kind of operate in, you know. But I like it, you know. I like the Calgary's my home, you know, and I feel like I get out there enough to like see the rest of the world, but I know where I'm from.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. So let's go back to growing up at Scarborough and just what your youth looked like, you know, whether you're playing sports or where music kind of got introduced to you.
Yeah.
And
so,
wind it back.
All of the above. I mean, we played tons of sports, you know, with two brothers. Scarborough now is a pretty exclusive neighborhood.
That's fancy.
But in like, in the 70s, it was a bit more normal neighborhoody. But in 1981, the community put in what was called the barricades, which prevented any eastbound traffic from entering the neighborhood off 17th Avenue. And it cut the traffic down to like nothing. And so suddenly you had these really big streets that were empty. So as kids, because I was like five in 81, it meant street hockey. It meant, you know, like, bikes. It just was like this, we had this huge space in front of us to play. So we could just have, you know, proper street hockey games with two nets, and there was tons of kids in the neighborhood. It was all a lot of young families, and so we developed strong bonds with our friends on the street and in the neighborhood. There was a babysitting co-op where parents would gather on Friday nights, dump their kids at one parent's house under the eye of two babysitters, and all the parents would go to the Sonalta gym and play badminton and then retire to someone else's party for drinks afterwards. So it meant that all the kids got to know each other in the neighborhood, you know, from like church, we went to Sacred Heart, to school, you know, and half the kids went to Sonalta, the other half went to French school with like me. You know, but so it meant like our neighborhood was really tight. And I can count, like, it takes two hands to count the number of friends I still have from that era. You know, my best pals were Pat Kelly, Dave Lawrence, and Paul Spence. You know, so those three are all pretty famous in their own rights for success in radio, acting, film. So it's pretty neat that the four of us all like kind of grew up together since we were like babies, you know, but we've just always been a gang. Pat and I were roommates in Toronto, you know, like Dave and his wife lived at our place for a while, and we had like, you know, it's just, it's lifelong pals.
Yeah. You know? It's rare, isn't it?
I think so.
I think it's, you know, there's, I have a friend, Tom Waterhouse, that's coming to Calgary in October. And I've known him since kindergarten.
Yeah, right.
I kind of grew up in the same neighborhood. And it's, I don't know. I don't know if a lot of people have these.
We stayed in the same house for the whole time.
Yeah.
My folks split and moved out of the house in like 2002 or something like that. You know, we moved into that house in like 77, you know? And so those 25 years, that stability, you know, when I speak about privilege, living in one house with the same parents for 25 years, that's like the best foundation a kid can have. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I aspire to. Mm-hmm. And like, likewise, you know, Pat Kelly lived down the street from me. I had this guy, like I met him when I was two. You know, I got this picture of us sitting on our front deck. It's him and his brother, me and my middle brother, and then my youngest brother is a baby, like a newborn. So it's clear, and it's spring, and he was born in the fall. So it's like, you know, that means it's spring of 1980 in the picture. And the Kelly boys are super, they're laughing in the picture. And it's just clear that they're at home. They are comfy sitting there with my mom, with the baby, me and my bro, you know, and it just like, we've been that tight since we were babies. Mm-hmm. And it's great. Yeah. You know, like we're still super close, you know, I introduced him to his wife, you know, friendships been an amazing part of my life. Yeah. I've been really fortunate to maintain some incredible friendships, mm-hmm. you know, not just from when I was a kid, from every stage. It was definitely a key feature of me being me when I was a teenager. It was friends.
It's interesting, you know, those three names that you rattled off. I played hockey with Pat and Paul, mm-hmm. and I went to high school with Dave.
Yeah, you played Royals, right?
Yeah, yeah. But grew up playing Trails West too.
With these guys. So did I, right? Well, that's because we probably played hockey together.
Yeah, I don't like...
Because I played hockey with all those guys too.
Yeah, so it might have been... I was a year younger than all of them. So,
okay.
So if you would have played with them like your second year all the time, and then you would have moved on.
So I'm 47. I skipped a grade.
Are you born in 76?
I was.
So I'm born in 77.
Ah, okay. Very good. So those guys were all 76ers.
Yeah.
Yeah. But same. You know, like Optimist Arena.
Yeah, totally.
You know, that scene, Centennial Arena.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are my spaces, you know.
What I find fascinating is like the four of you, like all doing creative things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's super weird.
And do you feel like you're just about to get into like your teenage years, but you know, I didn't know you well when you're like, I knew of you.
Sure. Sure.
But I saw how those guys were operating in their teens.
Right.
And I can imagine as you run around in that pack, it gives you some confidence knowing that you can be creative. You can do things.
It was interesting because I spent a little bit of time away, and I guess I'll get to that point now because I spent some teenage years at boarding school.
Okay.
And Pat moved to Toronto. And so we kind of split apart in some of those teenage years and then reconnected as like young adults, really. But in those intervening years, we each kept following creative pursuits. Mm. And like, the first band I had, Paul was guitar player in, Mike Scaglione was the drummer, you know? Yeah, exactly. You know, you remember these guys, Dave Anderson, was bass player.
Yeah.
That was the first, you know, iteration of the Matt Masters band in 2001.
What was it called?
Same name as now, Matt Masters and the Gentlemen of the Rodeo. Never change your name. It's one of the number one things of branding, you know?
So crazy.
It drives me nuts when musicians change the name of their project. Mm-hmm. It's like, but I've been following you as this, and now I got to follow you as that. Stick with the same name.
Crazy.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's my old crew, you know? And like I say, Pat and I came back from a couple years living in Vancouver in the mid-90s, and Pat and I ended up rooming together, you know? Just through university years, you know? And then he up and moved to Toronto. And sure enough, a few years later, there I was in Toronto. And he was like, well, you might as well live here again, you know? And then Dave, you know, he stayed a Calgary guy, of course. And so our paths have crossed nonstop through creative processes. And we've worked together on things and the ups and the downs, you know, real friendships that are, that have that journey. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite blessed that those guys are all in my life, you know. I have other old friends too.
Yeah.
And but that little Scarborough, you know, the four of us, we have a few other friends from Scarborough. Like there's a woman named Jackie Smart. She's been our pal the whole duration as well. She's married to a great dude. He's great. Lorenzo Lecce, you'd probably remember him too. Yeah. He's hilarious, you know, all the guys.
Yeah, totally.
You know, so like I've known Jackie my whole life too, but she had her own gang, you know, like Pat and Dave and Paul, we were in our own way a little gang, you know? So
it's impactful, right? Like there's a reason we're like talking about this at length, because, you know, I think it is very rare. I kind of grew up in a similar atmosphere in Strathcona, and I have like solid friendships from like way back then that have set the foundation for a lot of things.
Totally. It's one of the reasons that I like living in the neighborhood where I do, because I want my kids to have that.
Yeah.
You know, we had a debate when we first moved to the neighborhood about what school our daughter should attend, the French school that I went to, Holy Name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the English school across the street. And we ended up going with English school across the street because more kids were from the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So we thought we'd have a better chance of having neighborhood friends.
Yeah.
And that ultimately for me was, you know, I love the fact that I could speak French. I'm really glad that my parents put me in French immersion, but like it wasn't our, you know, it wasn't the way for us.
Yeah.
So all our kids go to English school, but it's across the street. you can't really argue with that.
Well, you remember those kids that had the, you know, their parents would go to work all day, but they lived across the street. And then it's like, well, I guess we're going for lunch. Like there's always that house, you know, right across the street from the school.
Well, we lived across the street from Sinalta School, but I didn't go there because we were French and Catholic.
Mm.
So I always dreamed of going to the school across the street because I had to hike up to 17th to get the bus up to, you know, up to Killarney. Yeah. So maybe I just wanted to finally let my kids have that thing of walking to school. Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, I love walking to school with my kids. Mm. One of the great pleasures of my life is that I get to walk my kids to and from school every day. Mm. And that's been going on for 7 years in this neighborhood.
So cool, man.
Yeah, totally. It's one of the best.
So get into, you know, you're just kind of like going through junior high and high school and what you're up to. And,
yeah.
And
I wasn't really into music in grades 9 and 10. Grades 11, I came back to public school. You know, I went to boarding school for grade 9 and 10.
Okay.
Then I came back to public school. Went to St. Mary's, and I kind of hooked up with a crew of creative dudes who were really opened my eyes to music. You know, I was a bit square coming out of boarding school.
It was boarding school.
No, I was a super nerd and wanted to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without
telling my parents.
No way.
At 12 or 13,
you
applied for and wrote an entrance scholarship exam, which I got, and didn't tell my folks until they got the call like a week before being. Hey, we're looking forward to having Matt out here on Vancouver Island. And they were like, what the fuck is this? What the fuck is this? And I was like, applied to boarding school.
What? Like, what was the...
I had a friend who was there
okay.
who told me it was awesome. I hated school in Calgary.
Hmm.
And, you know, I was 13, ready to move out.
Had it all figured out.
And, you know, I was there for 2 years. I had the scholarship. It ran out. I came home.
Oh, crazy. You know,
Yeah, I loved my time out there.
Mm-hmm.
I actually just went back for our 30th anniversary reunion.
Cool.
Because even though I didn't graduate from there, they invited me back for the 30th anniversary. Very nice. And had a really nice time. It was cool to connect with old friends.
Yep.
And now I don't think I can afford to send my kids there, but it was a good experience for me.
Sounds awesome.
It made me a super nerd to come back to school, though. You know, like I got back to St. Mary's wearing a tie.
Right.
You know, I walked into boarding or public school still like a super square.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was listening to stage musicals and, like no clue about what was pop culture or like debating whether or not hip hop was real, you know, and friends being like, here are some records. You will listen to these records.
And what were they?
So I went on a record shopping trip, with my late friend, Andy Sparacino, and we bought,
Did you go to the attic? Where were you?
No, I think we each went to A&B.
Okay.
Digwell Planets, Blowout Comb, about a Far Side album. We bought, a compilation, of stuff that had a few other bands on it, but like, also he kind of introduced me to some like Washington DC punk rock, like the Descendants, and then just started getting me into other bands like the Flaming Lips. And so it really was like this sudden awareness shift of music.
Okay. I gotta cut you off now. Do you think, because I had the same experience going to Mary's.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up playing hockey, you know, it was like Metallica and Pearl Jam and, you know, Guns N' Roses. It was like the typical
radio music.
Yeah. I got to Mary's and met Pat, Dave, Paul, Barrett, all those guys.
Mike Barrett, my cousin.
Yep. So they're all listening to like NoFX, Bad Religion.
Yeah.
They might be Giants. Like,
right.
All the, and that was my exposure.
Well, those guys all went to Madeline DeWitt Junior High. So I did too for grade 7 and 8.
Okay.
So that was like, that was a lot of the Holy Name crew
mm-hmm.
that went to Madeleine Douay. It's the French Catholics, right? Mm. And then they all ended up at Mary's.
So why,
But then it marries. What happened was Andy Sparacino. This guy was, he was so important to the history of music in our community. And it's under the radar.
Yep.
Andy came from Bonavista. His pals all went to St. Francis. And they were the guys who made the band The A-Team. And Andy went to Mary's instead. And so he connected all these St. Francis kids with all these St. Mary's kids, all these French Catholic kids who had gone to, you know, school together, our group, met with Andy and his group, who were all crazy music fans. And there was this real cool scene. And then a few other guys kind of came in with impact, Dan Vacon, of course, and had a huge musical sensibility. And was listening to stuff that others weren't and bringing people into, you got to check this out, you know, Dinosaur Jr., bands like that, Buffalo Tom, bands that no one else, like people today don't even know about these bands, but like this is 1991, you know. Part of this St. Francis crew was a guy named Dan McKinnon, who also recently passed. And Dan had two older brothers, and his older brothers, Rob and John, had a band called the Ramada Gods. And the Ramada Gods were a garage band in Calgary in the late 80s and early 90s. And they were not great, but super cool. Like they were having the best time and they were awesome in every way. And they had this, like, their house had this, you know, like the family house, the McKinnon family house, had a ridiculous red shag carpet room in the basement with a bar where they practiced. So they became known as the Ramada Room and they became the Ramada Gods. And the Ramada Gods were these like cool older brothers, you know, and then they influenced Andy and Danny, who then brought this music to the St. Mary's scene. And in 1992 and 1993 and four, while Alberta was having stuff like InFest and SunFest and all these big, you know, rock and music festivals that were pretty new for this community, there was this meshing of minds of about, you know, probably more like a dozen or 16 musicians who were all kind of just hanging out and starting to play music. And so, you know, that's Paul started his band, The Infernos, you know, Danny Vacon had his band with Pat Downing, the Dudes, you know, Pat and Andy and Danny and Keith Ritchie had the A-Team. And these bands in like 93, 94, 95 were Phil and Calgary clubs. The A-Team was a hip hop band playing weird hip hop that would, you know, it was kind of ahead of its time. And since it was on an island of Calgary, no one ever learned about it. You know, the Dudes became a pretty successful rock band out of Calgary. Paul, you know, he launched his career, the Fubar Guys, you know. So there's a lot of art that came out of that scene. And to me, it was really that when Andy and Dan McKinnon, the two guys from Bonavista and St. Francis, connected with all these 17th Avenue guys, you know. And that was, and then they got a house, Rock Central, off in Vic Park, and suddenly they had a headquarters, you know, and a whole scene built up around it. You know, we started a Rock Central Stampede Breakfast, this like kind of legendary Calgary punk rock festival that ran for 10 years. And I really, you know, that it's been the foundation of my music work, right? And so I know this story and I think about it a lot. And I really think the importance of those two guys. And the fucked up thing is they both just died. Like Andy and Danny both died like 3 weeks of each other. You know, and that sucks.
What's interesting is that, like, how, like, I felt the same thing about music, like, out of this, like, one high school. And it's so interesting to hear, like, the behind the scenes, right? These older guys, because I came in, I was younger, right? So to hear, when I think about the guys that got me into it, they were getting influenced by somebody else. So it's so interesting to hear how it all
started. We're all like that, right? We're all like that. We've always got that older friend, a brother or sister. You know, I was just thinking about the way my older sister influenced me musically. You know, she was 3 years older than, is 3 years older than me. And she introduced me to punk rock before I knew what it was. You know, she was in high school. I was still like junior high. And she was into like, you know, SNFU and you know, some pretty heavy stuff. But it didn't, that didn't stick with me, you know, but in later years when I, as an adult and came back to music, I was like, oh, I know this song. Like I remember this song, singing in the van, like, you know, and, you know, so, but I've often had that, you know, reconnecting with music through the years, you know, so yeah. And then I got my first guitar in high school when I was 15.
So as you got exposed to this new music, you're like, I can.
Yeah. I started wanting to, I just wanted to play. My dad played around the house.
Yep.
And and my sister played piano around the house and she could play guitar too. So I was like, I guess I'd just like to have a guitar. Mm. And so my dad got me a guitar for my 15th birthday and I started playing mostly to meet girls, you know. But I could sing okay, you know, and like, so I joined the choir at school. Like, it was kind of weird, you know, like, but I was still a bit of a nerd, you know. I was in the musical and then the theater or the choir director was like, would you join the choir? Because we need more guys. And I was like, yeah, I'll join the choir, you know. And I didn't think I was uncool, you know. I was just like, I'm just in the choir singing like whatever choir songs, you know. So, yeah, I started playing songs. I didn't start writing songs right away, and I certainly had no ambition to work in music. Mm. I just was a young kid with a guitar, you know, and it was like that for quite a few years. For probably like in 96, after I finished high school and did a year at university, I took a year off and moved to Lake Louise and did some traveling in Europe. Mm-hmm. Then did another year at university and then took another year and a half off and moved to Vancouver. And when I was in Vancouver, I was living with a bunch of musicians.
Yeah.
And I was just working day jobs. You know, I worked in a restaurant, worked in a clothing store, and then I eventually settled in with a job in a law firm where I was like a clerk. I just type data, you know.
Sounds horrible.
You know, it wasn't so bad. I had a window seat with a view of the mountains.
Did you get to wear a tie?
Oh, yeah. But I was all over. Remember, I was a boarding school guy. I can tie ties in my sleep. You know, so
shitty khakis and a tie.
Especially on the West Coast. You know, when I'm on the West Coast, I toss on a tie. And so, like, you know, my roommates were all like going to Vancouver Film School and working at like, you know, indie diners and stuff. And I was like wearing a tie going downtown to the corporate world, but I was making the most money, you know, and 10 bucks an hour.
Loaded.
But then after that, so the formative moment then in Vancouver was I was up with a friend. We were on acid. My roommate and I, Dallas, we were decided to write a country song because we thought contemporary country was so bad that we could easily best it on our first try. Because we had such disdain for the scene, you know, Garth Brooks, like the kind of Travis Tritt types, you know, it just was like so gross to me.
Mm-hmm. Was music just kind of like with you the entire time? Like it's just, you were just.
Yeah, it just, was right. Like, cause my parents are musical.
Yeah.
And my mom was in stage theater or stage plays when she was, you know, in university and stuff. My dad played guitar on the campfire. Yeah. You know, we had a piano in our house. Mm-hmm. You know, I took piano lessons as a kid. I was in the Mount Royal Junior Boys Choir as a kid. I played saxophone in junior high.
Yeah.
You know, so like there was steady music around.
And then as you're bouncing around between university and moving and stuff, you just got this guitar and it's just like, well, music is part of it.
I started thinking about it a bit more. You know, and then it was really when we finished high school and these friends, Andy and the A-team, you know, just started doing gigs. Yeah. And I was like, this is a thing. Like, you can just get on stage and sing your songs and people dance and everyone loves you.
You might make $10.
What the heck? You know, and so I first hung around like with that A-team scene a lot. And they had a thing where they invited, their original name was A-team Live Action Stunt Show. And they would have a bunch of friends jump up on stage and dance around. You know, there was one friend who wore a gorilla outfit, another friend who wore like a wrestling singlet, another guy dressed like a construction worker. And my role was the dance cop. So I wore like a PVC black vinyl outfit with a Bobby's hat, dark aviator shades, and I had plastic handcuffs. And my song was called The Game. And the lyric was, if when the music starts playing, start dancing. When the music stops playing, stop. Anybody left caught dancing will be stopped by the dancing cop. And then Andy would shout, stop. I'd jump off the stage and handcuff anyone still dancing because they had to freeze. And that was like my first experience on stage. Awesome. You know, was hanging with those guys.
Yeah.
It was just like hijinks.
Unbelievable.
Dancing, being silly. You know, then Andy started giving me the mic to rap to a song of his. He had a song called Labatt Wildcat. And I would rap to that in French for a verse, you know.
Where are you doing this? Like, are you at the
Night Gallery? Okay. Yeah, the factory.
Yep.
You know, the factory was a scene of a lot of gigs. The Works, the Carpenters Union Hall, the Republic, you know, like the Castle Pub.
Yeah.
You know, like the A-team would play anywhere. And then obviously like the Stampede Breakfasts, you know, like 500 people would show up at the Stampede Breakfast at this house in Vic Park. You know, so that was actually one of my first experiences on the mic, you know, and then from that, I kind of developed this character called Matt Masters that my my roommate in Vancouver, like after our acid writing song trip, he, in the morning, another roommate was like, oh, good song. You should be called Matt Masters and the Gentleman of the Rodeo. And I was like, oh my God, that is the best name ever. And I wrote it down. And that was like 97.
Did the roommate, the other roommate have any like...
passing comment, going out the door.
See you later.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly. Got to go to school.
No way.
Yeah.
And you're like...
Oh yeah. Instantly, light bulb on. Like, it's a hell of a name, you know? But I didn't do a Matt Masters gig till like 1998 or 99.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't like I was like, that's what I've been waiting for. Mm-hmm. You know, I just wrote down the name.
Yeah.
And then I moved back to Calgary, kept going to school, university.
What were you taking?
I did a history degree. Yeah.
And you're kind of like in and out of it just because your interest would go somewhere else?
It took me 9.5 years to do a 4-year program.
Awesome.
So I wasn't in a rush.
And history just because? Like it was just.
That's when I came back from Vancouver. That's what I was closest to getting for the degree. I was like, well, what am I closest to getting? They're like, well, you're closest to a history degree. I was like, that's what I'm going for.
There we go.
You know, I was going to be in liberal arts no matter what. But I mean, I truly loved history. I grew to love history. And it turns out it was obviously the right choice for me. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, let me think, where was I?
You get back to Calgary, yeah.
Yeah. And get back into school, you know. And then I just kind of had started writing a couple tunes. Mm. And so I was finally in a spot where I was like, well, maybe I'll sing a few of them. And some friends of mine were doing this show called Hot Nuts and Popcorn at the old Loose Moose.
Yeah.
So when Loose Moose was in the Gary Theater, where the Ironwood is now, there were these two guys, Eric and Derek. And they had a show called Hot Nuts and Popcorn. It was kind of like a Letterman style live improv interview show. And so I was the musical guest a couple times. And I'd written a song called The Rodeo, and I'd written one called Speed Train. And like what I was realizing like was that all the songs I was writing sounded country. Now this is for a few reasons. One was I only had an acoustic guitar. I didn't have an electric guitar. And so everything had a folky sound just naturally because I was, you know, focusing on the acoustic. And then it just turned out that everything I sang sounded like country music. Like no matter what I was singing, it sounded like country music. And it got to the point where a few friends were just like, you know what, go for it. Just do it. Cause you're like, you're, this is how you sound.
Yep.
This is, you know, you're doing it. It sounds good when you sing in your deep voice, you know, like just go and sing your songs about the Bow River. And so I remember doing a gig at USC one time, you know, USC had some different physical configurations back then. There was a space, they called it the airport lounge. It's not there anymore.
Okay.
Anyways, I gigged there and I remember Dave Anderson coming around and he saw me and I had a cowboy hat on and I'd gone to a thrift store and bought an old cowboy shirt and some ridiculous cowboy pants.
This is like early 2000s?
Yeah, probably 2000.
Okay.
And he was like, you're really doing this, hey? At least like I heard you were doing this, but you're really doing this? And I was like, yeah, I need a bass player. He's like, okay. All right, I guess I'm hired, you know. And that's how bands begin.
Crazy.
Yeah, and then I gigged around, you know, I did like some more gigs around the UFC, you know? And then I started getting booked at the Ship, at the Night Gallery, that kind of thing as well. And so one of my first gigs at the Night Gallery would have been like September 2000 with Ray Kondo opening for him. And then within that year, you know, I'd open for Corb, I'd open for Nico Case, I'd open for Reverend Horton Heat, you know? So my first year gigging was like,
went off
pretty heavy,
yeah.
You know, but I was like pretty popular and I got on the cover of a Calgary Straight the summer of 2001. Mm-hmm. You know, I hadn't even really made a real record or anything. You know, I like recorded kind of a demo quality, even less than demo quality recording in at home on my dad's computer. You know, he had like a little voice to text microphone that was like a little thing, but that's what I used because that's what I had. That was called the Alberta Reporter. And so I just burned copies of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I finally got it pressed in 2003.
What do you think it was? Like, were you doing something? Was your sound different? Were you just like in the music world for so long that people knew you? Like,
No, back then nobody knew me. I was brand new, but like, it was because I was innovative.
Yeah.
Alt country didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
Right. In 2000, that wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. I was there were maybe four bands in Calgary who were doing what I was doing, mm-hmm. you know, like, which is essentially traditional country with a contemporary awareness, you know, postmodern country or whatever.
Yeah.
Tom Phillips, you know, back then, there was a few other bands. There was like, Junior Gone Wild, you know, and, then also, the Alien Rebels, you know, and that's like, that was about it. And Junior Gone Wild was pretty much an Edmonton band, and the Alien Rebels were a bit out of town. Tom Phillips was already doing it by the time I showed up on the scene. But nobody else, like, there weren't other 20-year-olds dressing in vintage Western wear. Like, nobody like Orville Peck existed. Just didn't exist.
That's the vision. I knew your name for all these years, and then I remember you popping back up, and that's the vision that I remember. The first time I'm like, there's fucking Matt.
98, 99, I'd cruise around Alberta and buy vintage Western wear because it was everywhere. It was like not like today. You would walk into a thrift store and you'd get like three suits that fit you perfectly, you know, your choice of shirts, because it just wasn't a thing, you know? And so I literally feel like I was the first guy in Calgary to realize that like button snap shirts are cool again in 2000.
Here we go.
And so I went and got them all. I bought them all.
You got them all.
Like I had the most ridiculous wardrobe. And, you know, and I just was into that for a show. You know, you dress up you know, for a show. And so like that was really different than any of my friends. You know, like all my friends making music would very much wear this clothes they wore on the street on stage. And there was even an ethos about that of being authentic to who you were. You know, I remember some friends teasing a touring band who they really admired because they saw they wore loungewear off stage. And I remember thinking like, oh, I don't know, that's not so bad, is it? Like, I like sweatpants too, but I still do. But, you know, get dressed up for the stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's never a bad idea. And I've always tried to maintain that, you know, like in my weekly shows, I don't push it as hard. But when I'm doing a big show at the Bella, you know, touring with Barney, then I like to dress it up a little bit.
Get it going.
Totally.
So like walk it through, you know, after you're seeing some success, you know, you're playing a bunch of places. Are you thinking that, like, music is your all in? Like, as you like?
No, still not yet at all. It was like,
are you working on the side or what are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, I had jobs in restaurants or university. I had jobs in a real estate office, doing like, I've always done a lot of administrative work, you know, so those would be kind of my two worlds, you know. I either had an admin job or I had a restaurant job. And gigging was just like becoming this thing, but it wasn't yet. At that age, I still didn't even see it as nobody I knew had a job in music. Not a single human I knew worked in music. So I moved to Toronto in the fall of 2002 because I'd finished university and a friend was getting married in the Bahamas and I was a best man. So I had to come and go from Toronto. And when I got back to the city after the wedding, another friend, Pat Kelly, was like, why don't you live here? He's like, I've got a guest room. Move in. And he's like, there's, you know, what's happening in Calgary?
This is the early 2000s, right?
Yeah, that would be now 2002.
Okay.
And so in 2002, Pat was a TV star in Toronto. He was on YTV. You know, he had a national, number one kind of kid show in the country, right? YTV, The Zone. So he was like on stage at Second City. He was doing a movie with Dan Aykroyd. You know, my roommate was like a movie star.
He was
awesome. And then like
a good guy.
A week into living there, like my very first gig, Jeff Healey shows up because I'm singing with Tara Hazelton, another, you know, longtime Calgarian. And she was singing with Jeff Healey Jazz Wizards at the time. So it's my first gig in Toronto, a little place called Graffiti's in Kensington Market. And Jeff shows up and Tara's already on stage and I'm singing after her. So Jeff's come and he's standing at the door because the very first seat by the door is already taken. So just kind of waiting till the song's over to ask someone to help him to a seat. So I just walk up and I'm like, hey, Jeff, it's Matt Masters, because I'd been introduced to him once already. And I was like, just come sit with me in my palace. He's like, great. So we come and sit back and I sit down with my two friends who are looking at me like they're freaking out, you know. And I am too. but he's just a guy. He's just a guy, you know. And he appreciated sitting there. I did my show. He listened. He was really supportive the whole time I lived in Toronto. And then, like, the next night we went out and I met, Brian Farrell from They Might Be Giant. Not They Might Be Giants. From the band from – his band was called Atomic Seven. Then the band did the music for Kids in the Hall. Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet.
Dude, I was no place to help.
Okay. So Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet, right? Yeah. But like, you know, this is just after the Kids in the Hall era. Like their music was like paramount, you know, in the scene. And these were like the guys I met on my first weekend in Toronto. And then within my first month, pretty much, I'd been hired to be the general manager of the Toronto Blues Society, which is a bit fucked up because I'm a country singing guy from Calgary. But I had event experience from Rock Central, and I had administrative experience from my time in offices. Mm-hmm. And I was on the scene already. I already knew Jeff Healy. Oh, I'd already played the show. I played at Silver Dollar last week, you know? And so that was, so the people who were doing the hiring, they, you know, rolled the dice, but they hired me and I was there for almost 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And,
enjoyed Toronto and like.
Loved it.
Really?
But you got to keep in mind, I was the general manager of the Toronto Blues Society. That meant my name was on the door at every club in the city. Mm. I just walked in. Hey guys. Hey, Matt. You know, like I've been in the city for less than a year and I my job was paying musicians, right? Toronto Blues Society is the largest music service organization in Canada, you know, thousands of members. And I was like producing the Maple Blues Awards. I was producing, you know, like all their whole slate of events. Mm. So for me, it was like, an introduction to the Canadian music scene.
Yep.
Suddenly I was working at a relatively high level, you know, working with national CBC broadcasts, working with like everything from unions to, you know, like commercial directors to just like all sorts of music business stuff. And I was being mentored by some of the giants of the industry who were, you know, spending time with Blue Society because of their commitment to the scene and the community, you know, like some of Canada's seminal band members. Like there's a band called Downchild Blues Band. You know, Downchild Blues Band, you know, influenced the Blues Brothers. You know, they're like, they're Canada's blues band. And, you know, their bass player, Gary Kendall, was on the board. So I got to hang with him every week.
Cool.
Richard Flohill, who's like the publicist who brought, you know, Van Morrison and B.B. King to Canada for the first time. He was there every week. And like just having pizza with these guys and talking music, you know, was a window into the scene I did not know. Mm-hmm. And so it was like going to music university, music business university.
Cool.
I met everybody, and it was in Toronto. And the TBS, as it was nicknamed, knew everybody because they'd already been around 20 years. So I was like, I was welcomed into industry conversations that has taken me 20 years to get back to.
Yeah,
you know,
because that's early, right?
To be super early, and I was just like, I had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember a friend from Toronto then saying to me, he's like, hey man, I'm going to be in Calgary doing an album. Do you know where I can get like this one amp in particular? And I was like, oh no, you can't get that in Calgary. Nope, can't do it. I don't know anybody who got it. Nope, nobody has it. And he was like, are you crazy? I called Tim Williams. He's got three of them, you know, that kind of stuff. But I was like, who's Tim Williams? And so when I came back to Calgary after 2 years in Toronto, I really had this awakening where I was like, oh, I don't even know my music scene. Because I knew my little gang of high school buddies.
Yep.
And that was it.
Yep.
And then I moved to Toronto. I had my eyes exploded and opened to the realities that there is, in fact, an international music industry. And then the thing I really learned in Toronto, though, was that you could be a working musician, that was an option. Mm. You didn't have to be Jeff Healy to have a house or some kids or, you know, like, or to pay your rent, you know. And I remember just being like, that's a choice. Like it was the same when I was shocked that you were allowed to do gigs. I was shocked that it was allowed to be your job. I couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I was 26 years old. No one had told me that I could do this for a job. At this point, I've been doing it for a few years.
Yep.
So that was the end of 2004. I woke up one day and I was like, you know what? I'm becoming too much of an administrator. I want to gig more, even though I was gigging like twice a week.
Which is...
In the coolest scene, you know, like, I mean,
scene.
Leslie Feist lived three doors down from us. Luke Doucette lived on the same block as us. You know, these are just the people you would see. Yep. These are the people in your neighborhood, you know. And not to mention the fact that I was in the blues scene, I got to meet so many cool blues musicians, you know, international ones too. But like one day I was like, no, you know what? It's time to go back to Alberta. I want to hit the road. I want to be a singer. Mm. So I just packed up. I resigned my job. Everyone's like, you're fucking crazy.
Wait, it does sound crazy though, right? Like,
I had an office on Queen Street. I wrote out my own paycheck. There was always beer in the fridge. My roommate was a movie star. Like, it was a very cool scene.
Yeah.
You know, and I was gigging lots. You know, I was getting on to cooler and cooler gigs. You know, I met some producers or some event producers who were booking me on things. Mm. You know, a guy, like one of them, a guy named Gary Topp. You know, he worked with the Ramones. He worked with Jonathan Richman. You know, he was booking me. He introduced me to Jonathan Richman, you know, like that was so crazy cool. Scene, you know?
Yep.
And I was like given a gold card to Toronto.
Yeah.
So that's why, like, so I love Toronto. Yeah, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because like when I go back, all my friends are still gigging all over the place, you know? So whatever I do in Toronto, I'm going to see a friend play.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm right now working on an album with a bunch of guys from Toronto and we recorded in Niagara Falls, you know, but like, came back into the city for one night and saw friends. You know, went to the Cameron House, saw friends, went to the Horseshoe, saw friends, mm-hmm. you know. So I really love the Toronto music scene. Yeah. And even though I haven't been there for 20, it's been, you know, 20 years since I moved home, mm-hmm. I still feel sort of part of it. Mm-hmm. And the first time I brought my wife to Toronto, it was pretty sweet. We went to the Communist Daughter, this little hole in the wall, kind of a Dundas. There was only one seat open. This place like fits like 12 people. Maybe there's like 6 seats at the bar, and then there's like literally no other. It's a tiny little space. And the guy sitting there at the end was like, "Oh, you guys need a seat? I'm just on my way out. You can take my seat." And we're like, "Oh, thanks." And my wife's like, "Was that Ron Sexsmith?" And I was like, "Yes, it was." And it just happened to be the guy at the bar. And then we go across the street to the Dakota Tavern, which is now a pretty famous Toronto bar, but back then it was just opening up. And the Beauties were playing, you know, a great Toronto band. Come down the stairs, and from the stage, the singer, Sean, goes, "Mayor of Calgary's in town." And my wife just looks at me like, "What the fuck is going on?" And it was just as good as it got, you know. It was a great moment. So I love Toronto for that, too.
Totally. You know? Yeah. What was the, was it the hometown pull to come back here? Or was it a mix between, like, you know, the hometown pull and, like, you know, scratching this musical itch? Like, can I do this full time, or can I travel and make money and work?
It's pretty hard to understand what made me want to come back to Alberta.
It's like you said, you had the gold card.
I really did. Like all my friends were starting to win Junos, yep. You know, like, and they've continued to win them. I have not won one. I've never been part of that, but that's okay. No, I don't really know what it was. And somehow though, I came back home, I bought a van, and then that was November, December. And then I went off to the island, you know, for the winter, because I didn't want to live in my van in Calgary for the winter. Mm-hmm. So I thought I could live in the island. So I spent like 2 months there, just kind of putzing around, playing some gigs, being a bit of a hobo. And I was hanging out with a friend in North Van, which van? You can't, so many vans.
Yeah, they're all of them.
And I was talking to about this friend of ours named Angus, Angus Taylor, he's a Calgary guy. You should be on the show. Mm. He's an entrepreneur. And he had a plan for the centennial year, 2005. To climb 100 mountaintops in Alberta. His grandpa had done 75 for the 75th. His goal is 100 for the 100th.
Cool.
And I was like, what a cool idea. Angus is so cool. Now he's a weed entrepreneur who like had a $30 million exit. Mm. He did really well. Mm. And now he has an international weed company.
Interesting.
He's a pretty interesting guy. Anyways, inspiring dude. And I was like, that's so cool. I should do that. I'll play 100 towns in Alberta this summer. So I just like said that. And then I was okay. And then I was just sad about that day. I was like, okay. What does this mean? And I started mapping out this 100 show tour. And then I figured it out. And by May, I started it.
Wow.
And so I did for the Alberta Centennial. I devised a show that was a history of Alberta show. One song written by an Albertan from each decade. So 10 songs. And amazing. I learned of all this because my history degree, totally helped, you know, my love of old time music, yeah. My interest in that kind of sound, mm-hmm. you know, this, like by this point, I'd long accepted that I was a country guy, you know, like my collections were very much country. I had delved into the history of country music and, you know, my parents liked Willie Nelson and Ian Tyson. And from Willie Nelson, I learned about like, you know, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, you know, and from Ian Tyson, I learned about traditional cowboy ballads and like Marty Robbins and stuff like that. And it really all stuck with me, mm. you know. So now I'm like a cowboy hat wearing dude, still wearing the good Western duds, driving around in a 79 van. And I do 100 shows in 120 days in Alberta for the centennial. And that raised some eyebrows. And for the first time, I got some media attention. Mm. Well, not the first time. I'd had some early success in 2001, but it was like a bit different. This was like full page spread in the Herald, you know, full page spread in the Golden Mail, mm. interview with the National, mm-hmm. you know, these were different things. And it also meant that 100 gigs, because I ended up doing more the rest of the year. That was just in 4 months I did 100. I made an income in music. Like suddenly I was like, oh shit, I made 50 grand this year. Mm-hmm. And I can pay for an apartment. So I got an apartment, you know.
Out of the van.
I was out of the van. That also for January 2006, right? So I was in the van for 14 months. Wait, man. You know? And like, you know, I stayed with my mom for a while. I wasn't like in the van every night for 14 months, but yeah. I didn't have rent for 14 months because I couldn't have done it any other way. I didn't have the income.
Yeah.
But after doing those 100 gigs, I started to build more of a network, you know, like by
and
large.
That's insane, right? Like that's a big number. Like that's a lot of gigs in a short amount of time.
How many days a week do most people go to work?
Fair.
It's not that many gigs.
Fair.
Gig only lasts an hour.
And wheel it back to the start of this conversation, yep. Right?
Music it's all worker. About work. Yeah. And like most people have that reaction. 250 dates a year? That's fucking crazy. What do? Oh, I go to work 250 days a year at a job. Because that's the standard, right?
Right.
You know, like 250 is 5 days a week.
Yeah.
I don't fucking tour 250 dates a year. That shit's crazy. You know, these guys who get up on tour and drive downtown and then work 250 days a year? Are you fucking kidding me?
I've never thought of it that way.
It's fucking crazy.
It's such a different perspective, right?
I mean, I'm a believer in the self-structured lifestyle. Mm. I happen to have been gifted with a talent that I recognized in my early 20s. I can sing and I can also songwrite. And I've been following that passion directly for 25 years. Mm. So I'm in a pretty good spot now because I've been able to plant some seeds and watch them grow.
Yeah.
You know, and it is an interesting journey, but most people can't really see it. Mm. You know, music has stereotypes that are different than any other industry because I'm a music fan. I understand music. I bought an album. Mm-hmm. I went to a concert. I even play guitar. You know, it's different than like, I buy gas. I use gas. Yeah. I understand the oil industry.
Yeah.
Nobody would say to an oil executive, I understand your industry because I buy gas. I use it every day. I got a propane heater.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the same as someone who is a non-professional being like, I'm a huge music fan. I love this band. Mm-hmm. I've gone to their show 50 times. Mm-hmm. Tell that person they don't understand music.
Yeah.
And they're like, fuck you, I understand music. Mm-hmm. Tell that person they don't understand the oil and gas industry. Well, obviously they don't. They're like, they don't. But everyone has an opinion on music. Mm-hmm. And so those opinions are based on what? Those opinions are mostly based on messages we get from media, which are mostly stereotypes.
Yeah.
You know, so musicians have a longer journey than a lot of other industries to legitimize themselves. Mm-hmm. You open a brick and mortar store, no one's going to question if you're in business.
Yeah.
But you do music for 25 years. And hey, you still doing music? It's like, yeah, still doing music.
You must hear it over.
Well, it's fascinating. You know, it's fascinating. And I don't begrudge someone for knowing music. I mean, of course not. But living in the world of music allows you to question some of the standard stereotypes about the way our community is, the way we live, you know, what our priorities are. My priority is family first. So I spend most of my time with my family. Mm-hmm. Work second. So I spend second amount of time at work, mm-hmm. you know? And like, luckily for me, I am able to do that because I started working on this project 25 years ago and I've gotten pretty good at singing, you know?
It's not an overnight.
Yeah, it's not an overnight. It's not an overnight, which is kind of the, it's one of the stereotypes that have to be defeated. You know, no one becomes an architect overnight. You have to go to school for 10 years. But when you have your first big building that's like you wins an award or something, people congratulate you, but they don't give you like a best first job award because obviously you've had other jobs before that, mm-hmm. you know. But in music, it's like you make 10 albums, no one buys it. Someone buys one and you win a best newcomer award.
Yeah, totally.
One of the things is there's music and there's the music industry. And then there's like another thing. Because like the music industry is mostly about selling records. So there's music, which is like what people enjoy. There's the selling of records, which is a whole international economy. And then there's live performance, which has nothing to do with selling records. Mm-hmm. Like they're totally separate. You mm-hmm. might sell records at a live performance,
yep.
but it's like saying there's storytelling, there's movies, and there's theater. Obviously, theater and movies are different. And if you're a stage actor, you're not necessarily a film actor.
Yeah.
But if you step on stage as a musician, where's your recording? Of course, you got a record. You can't get this gig without a record. It's like, well, I'm a performing artist. Well, no, but you need a record. It's like, well, what do I need to like know how to use a unicycle too? Like, what's another thing that I don't need to do this?
Yeah.
You know? And so for me, it's always driven me because I've never had a record label. I've never had a manager, you know? Fortunately for me in Toronto, I learned a lot about the biz And fortunately for me, with my, you know, administrative background, entrepreneurial parents, I kind of found a seam, you know. And I've had 200-day gig years, but I've also found these other music jobs. And so that's become my way of balancing. Because when I started having kids, especially, so 11 years ago, I didn't want to be away like I had before that. Before that, I was like cool with a summer that was mostly on tour. But that wasn't, that's not my plan anymore. So I started having to find ways to supplement my living, you know. And so, like I say, booking nightclubs, working in advocacy, doing, working in radio. I spent a couple of years with CKUA, you know. And so those are just like, those are the ways you make it happen if you're not selling enough, you know. And I don't sell a lot of records, like not very many.
It's not your...
I wish I did. Yeah, you know, I've tried my hardest. I've tried everything in my power to sell a lot of records, but I have never sold a lot of records, you know.
The way it is.
Yeah, just the way it is. You know, like I can't really, can't fault myself. I've made some very good records. I'm making a record right now with the guys from the band Bahamas. You know, like they just headlined Calgary Folk Fest. And will anyone buy it? Remains to be seen.
you were talking about that, like, when you did your all those gigs and you started getting press, when you're getting press at that in those moments, are you feeling like I'm here? Are you feeling like I'm on my way? Are you feeling like I'm just I'm doing the right thing right now?
Well, I had a quick hard lesson with that in 2001 when I had my very first Calgary Straight cover. I quit my job.
No way.
Yeah, I was working in a hotel as a doing like conference, you know, set up. Not a great job. And I had so many gigs that month. And I was like, I was rolling in dough. I was on the cover of a magazine. Fuck it, I'm done. And then August came and I was like, whoa, I'm broke, man. So I got another job, you know. So I'd already had this quick realization that just because I was on the cover doesn't mean I'm have a job. You know, and so yes, I could feel my profile raising and I could feel the status of my gigs raising and you know, my pay level increasing with it. But the media didn't like, I'd already been like spoiled, but like I already understood it. Like media is a part of our toolkit in doing our job. You know, like some people use Microsoft Excel. I use the media. It's just a tool you use to tell your story. You know, and so I've always understood that. Local man plays concerts. Centennial tour. Hits 100 towns with historic, you know, review. That's a headline. And like to bring it up to the future, you know, curbside concerts, man on van is a story. Man on the corner is busking. Man on van, that's a national headline. And you have to understand that as an artist. Well, you don't, or maybe if you have to understand as a publicist, but like, if you want to be in media, you have to work with media to tell your story.
This is fascinating, dude. My mind's just like, so where does it go? You know, after the big tour, where's this thing get going?
So then like I went hardcore for the next year, you know, 2006 was on the road for the whole year. You know, I toured everywhere. From the Pacific to the Atlantic across Canada. I toured down to the Gulf of Mexico, spent a month in Texas. But then actually in, so January of 2007, I was in Texas. And I had a bit of an eye-awakening moment or an eye-opening moment, you know. I was pretty much just like a bit of a waste case. I'd been out one night with some folk singer. I don't remember who. We'd drunk a bunch and done a bunch of pills, and I don't even remember what. And I woke up in my place, and it was clear that I had had a visitor the night before. And I had no recollection of it at all. And I was just like, fuck, I gotta start respecting myself. And I was kind of living that life, you know. I was just like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I was quite satisfied with that lifestyle. It's kind of what I'd been aspiring to, you know. Here I was now in Texas for a month. I played some significant shows down there. You know, I got to sit in with some artists. Like Dale Watson invited me on stage. That to me is like a, you know, hero kind of moment. And here I was at the same time, like barely hanging on because I was just like a fucking waste. You know, I was just so into partying. And I was never like an alcoholic. I was never a drug addict, but I had a very open door policy. My policy was no crack, no needles. But if it's offered to you, take it, take it.
open.
Don't buy it. Never buy it. Because if you don't buy it, you probably aren't going to get addicted to it. Mm. And that was my thing with cocaine in particular. You know, like, if you're buying it, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
But if you're like doing it at a party, you're probably going to be fine. And that's like, that was kind of my policy, you know? So it got me into the point where I was, you know, not in a good spot.
Yep.
So I came home from Texas with like an intent to like, it was time to clean up my act.
Yeah. You thought this through. You're like, I need to change.
Yeah. Like it was enough of a life event, you know, where I was like, this is fucked up. Like, I don't like how I feel.
Yep.
I don't like who I am right now. Like, I should be loving it. I'm in Texas, I'm playing music, and I was, you know, I was playing cool clubs, and I was kind of on the Austin scene for that 1 month.
Yep.
You know, I got to meet people that I really mm-hmm. enjoyed meeting. And, yeah. So I came back home and I was just like, I'd written a couple songs down there that were meaningful. And then I met my wife, and I went out to an art show and met this woman, asked a friend who was the artist. I was like, who's that? She's like, dude, that's your next door neighbor. So it turned out that Amanda, my wife, was living in apartment 2 to my apartment 4.
Come on.
For over a year.
Come on.
But because I was such like a nightlife party yeah. maniac, and because she was like a gravity pope.
Yep.
We never crossed paths. We'd seen each other. She recounted. We'd seen each other once. Mm-hmm. I'd held the door open for her on her bike once or something like that. But I had no idea who this person was. And anyways, I asked my friend. She was like, well, that's your next door neighbor. So we started dating. And we were already living together, you mm-hmm. know, because like we literally did live together.
Yeah.
And so we had a, you know, a quick romance and quickly, you know, fell in love. And then... you know, kind of started on that different journey, but like musically speaking, kept on the same path.
Mm-hmm.
In 2007 and 8, I founded a festival called Spaghetti Western Festival, which was like a alternative sounds and country music festival at Olympic Plaza. It ran for 10 years.
No way.
Yeah. Third Saturday in August.
Yep.
And Amanda was a big part of that the whole way through. She's a musician too, a flute player in the classical world.
Cool.
But then the big one, 2008, I wrote a play. So like in the winter 2003, I spent 2 months in Spain. A friend needed a house sitter
yeah.
and I jumped at the chance. And it was in southern Spain. It was in near a town called Fuengirola, which is like so close to Gibraltar that you can see Gibraltar and you can see Morocco. Okay. Like you're right there.
Yeah.
And so I read Don Quixote while I was there. And I was inspired by it. And I wrote a couple songs about a guy named Don Coyote, who was like Calgarian, who'd watched too many John Wayne movies and lost his head and thought he was living in the Old West, much like Don Quixote thought he was living in the days of knights errant. And so then like fast forward a couple years, 2007, 2008, another guy named William Bearwalt, who was a curator at ACAD at the time, asked me if I had ever thought of writing a play. He's like, 'cause I kind of think you should. And I was like, well, fuck yeah, I do. I have already got this song. And he was like, great, let's write some grants and make it happen. So I collaborated with a friend of mine named Terrence Houle, who's a Blackfoot artist here in town. We set about writing a play. So in 2007, we wrote Don Coyote, which was like a 50-page script. And it was like a two-man show with a band on stage and some visuals. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like a spoken word piece, but it's 7 songs. And it told a story about a mentally ill person dealing with homelessness and some of the power dynamics that come between white and indigenous people. And so it was pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. It was well received. It was part of the first Sled Island. We did a dozen dates at Glenbow. Then we took it to Nuit Blanche in Toronto. I don't know if you know Nuit Blanche, but
I've heard the name.
Nuit Blanche is this international fair. It's a 12-hour festival that happens from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. Mm. And I'm not kidding, 500,000 people go.
No way.
Like the streets of Toronto are packed shoulder to shoulder. So in 2008, Don Coyote was part of that. And it was pretty high profile. We had like, the largest indoor venue of the entire festival. So 8,000 people saw our play that night.
Wow.
And we were ranked number 7 or 8 in the must-sees by the Toronto Star, which put us one ahead of Yoko Ono and her installation. So it was like,
yeah. Yes.
Okay. That time I was more like, we have arrived, you know, but the truth of the matter was like, it was an indie play. Mm-hmm. I made like almost no money from it. You know, it took a long time. It destroyed my band at the time. I had a really kick-ass band. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I'm taking off 9 months or something to write a play. Mm-hmm. So there's no piano in it. So go join another band. And they all did, you know? And so it was a great experience, but it also kind of like was a bit of a bummer because I lost my band, you know, but like I did it in London, England. I did it at a festival in Ontario. We did it on radio. We did it at High Performance Rodeo, you know, so it had a good life.
Yep.
You know, we haven't touched it since 2010. Mm-hmm. But you know, we still have it. I'm super tight with Terrence still. So, you know, in theory we could do it again sometime. So that really was like 2007, 2008, 2009 kind of was like Don Coyote time. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I also joined a band from the West Coast in 2007. I was in Moose Jaw at the Western Canadian Music Awards. And this guy gets up on stage and starts singing a song that my friend from Toronto had written, Corin Raymond, songwriter. And the song was called 3,000 Miles. And the singer was Dustin Bentall. So I elbow the guy next to me. And I'm like, hey, my friend wrote this song. And it's Barney Bentall next to me. And he's like, hey, that's my kid singing it. And I'm like, holy shit. So I just go, do you want to go sing backups? And he's like, yes, I do. So we both like arm in arm kind of walk up on stage and just start singing. You know, I know all the words. He knows all the words. And I'd only ever met Dusty like maybe once or twice before. Like I didn't really know him at all.
Yeah.
And obviously never met Barney before. But we just jammed and the vibe was so cool that at the end of the night, Barney was like, hey, you know, we're doing a concert in like October. Do you want to come out to the West Coast and do a couple of shows with us? And I was like, I would fucking love to. So thankfully, my brother John worked for WestJet at the time. So I hopped on WestJet. Got out to the West Coast and did this show with Barney. The band is called the Grand Caribou Opry. Now, the band's been renamed to the Caribou Express. And I've been in that band for 17 years.
No way.
Yeah.
Dude, I thought this was going to be like a weekend story.
We've raised $5 million for Western Canadian charities.
No way.
We've performed with everyone from, you know, Jim Cuddy to Tom Wilson to like, you know, you name them. And the Caribou Express is like, so I mentioned earlier, I'm out of town in November because mm-hmm. I'm on tour with the Express each November. So mm-hmm. each November we do about a dozen dates and they're all fundraiser shows and they're badass fundraiser shows. Mm. So we work in Calgary with Classroom Champions, a really cool charity whose CEO should be on your show.
Cool.
And, so that's like, that started in 2007.
Wow.
Now it's 2023.
Wow.
You know, so we're coming up on our, next year will be the 20th anniversary of the band and our 10th anniversary in Calgary. And so that's a big part of my life. Mm. You know, my time with Barney is really important to me. It's where I get to flex my musical muscles the most. You know, I have a 7-8 piece band backing me up. I get to play theaters, you know, and I kind of co-host the show with Barney.
Cool.
So the two of us, you know, we just have fun and raise a lot of money and rock out with
like big money.
Yeah, like really big money. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, our Calgary show does six figures for sure.
Where is it?
At the Bella Concert Hall at Mount Royal University.
Okay.
The Taylor Center for Performing Arts. Mm. In Vancouver, we play the Vogue. You know, last year we played Toronto at the CBC building for the Glenn Gould Theater. Ron McLean was on the show with us.
Cool.
You know, so cool.
Massive.
He name dropped me on Hockey Night in Canada 2 days later. Like
that's when you just retire.
Seriously.
As like a,
it was like a Flames win after a Flames like drought. And Ron's like, well, they'll be celebrating at the King Eddie at Masters Friday afternoon happy hour this weekend. That's a Calgary tradition. I was like, what? You know, but like,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really weird. Like I'm part of that scene.
Yeah.
Like I know all those guys, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I've known a lot of the Blue Rodeo guys since I lived in Toronto, but like, Barney has introduced me to everybody, you know, like the Spirit of the West guys, you know, at the last Spirit of the West gig, I was pulled on stage by, you know, by the band just to dance in the, you know, just to hang out and dance. And I'm like next to Sarah McLachlan. And I'm like looking at her like, hey, Sarah McLachlan, you know, I had your record in grade 11, you know? And so it is like, it's amazing to me that I'm in those spots because I'm not like, like that. That was a great example that, the last Spirit of the West gig was at the Commodore in Vancouver. Everyone on that stage, you're familiar with. And I was on that stage. And it was like a friend in Calgary was like, did I see you on the stage at that thing? And I was like, yeah, that was me back there, just bald head in the background, you know? So
crazy.
Yeah. But that's like, it's kind of, that's my career. You know, like I've been working with these guys for 17 years, but most people in Calgary have no idea that I do that. You know, I'm the guy at the King Eddie who plays Friday afternoons at a free show. Pass the hat.
Still, you know? Hey?
Oh yeah. That's part of my day job.
I see. I need to come check that out.
Yeah. It's like, that's my day job, you know? And every now and then I tour around doing art music with the Caribou Express, but I'm a crafts person who every Friday does a happy hour show.
Go to work.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
I love your perspective. I love hearing it because it's such a, so different as a very creative person, you know, it makes so much sense. It just,
Work is work, right?
Yeah.
And like, that's the thing that like people just have a hard time believing because they're like, oh, you musicians are lazy. You're wasted. You're, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you're honestly, have a talk about music with anybody, you're hard pressed not to hear a stereotype.
Yeah.
Someone's going to say starving artist.
Yeah, for sure.
In the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
About someone who's done 3,000 gigs, you know, about someone who's worked at the highest level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still like, still doing music, eh? yeah. Yes, I am. You know, just raised $5 million over there.
Still doing it.
You know? And we haven't even got to like, you know, the curbside.
Well, that's it. It's a perfect segue. I was just going to take you there.
Yeah, so, for sure. So after years and years.
Like years and years.
Yeah. So the pandemic hits.
Yeah.
And we're a music income family, right? So my gigs and my wife's teaching, that's our family income. Mm-hmm. And now we can't do it. So we have a month of money. And so I was downstairs crying. I came up with this idea and I registered a website, curbsideconcerts.ca. The idea was pretty straightforward that with existing technology that I had, I could use a battery powered speaker, stay at the curb, and you could hear my speaker because sound travels. You stay at your door, sit on your stoop, have a concert.
Yeah.
Don't step on your neighbor's yard. Stay at home, stay safe.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that. Then to give it a bit of pizzazz, to make it a story, we built a stage. Or had a friend build a stage, I should say, for the roof of my caravan. And within 7 minutes, I could unload, build the stage, get it on the roof of the caravan, and then climb up and do a concert. So I'd park my van in front of your house and do a concert. And we launched the idea, and it really caught on.
I remember the press got it.
It, you know, a bit strategic there. I had TV cameras on my first four gigs, you know. That's like, I'm a media guy, you know, I just called my friends. Hey man,
you're a professional.
Got any feel good stories? No. Oh, was there a pandemic on? Come here. I have a feel good story for you. Yeah. There's kids involved, you know, there's smiling children.
Mm-hmm.
And, so like our first week we were on all the channels and then we did like CBC radio, you know, whatever, the drive home show or something. And, so the whole city knew about us.
Yeah.
And we booked 100 gigs in 4 days and we was just me.
I love that.
It was crazy, right? Like you don't book 100 gigs in 4 days. And so, I was instantly overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So I instantly started building a company because I was like, I need someone to help me with this. Like I'm losing stuff.
Yeah.
I'm losing track of people, you know, cause it was coming in on every medium.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
People were texting me, people were tweeting me, people were Instagram messaging me, and I didn't want to lose any of it because these were all gigs. And so we harnessed them all. And had a little bit of admin help, we started hiring. And then I realized right away that this was gonna work in other places. So I called my friend Rami Mays in Winnipeg. And I was like, do this now. And she was like, yeah, I get it. So she started doing it right away and it caught on in Winnipeg. Same thing, bands on vans and a feel good story. And Rami had the same access to media that I did. So she called all her friends and everyone in Winnipeg media showed up. We couldn't do the same thing in Vancouver or Toronto because we didn't have the same access to media.
Yep.
But in Calgary and Winnipeg, we launched and we launched big. And we did 550 concerts that summer with like about probably 40 different artists, you know, because I knew I couldn't do all these dates,
yeah.
You know, so I just got to farm them out. So first I called my band members, you know, and one of them was like, I don't want to do this, but another one's like, I'll totally do that. You know, so that was the start, was my band members. But then I realized that all three of us were white dudes. We needed some ladies. So like, you know, we signed up Michaela Sheedy, you know, and then like, I was like, well, this is all white. So then we started like hiring artists of color, and we started hiring, you know, indigenous artists, and we started hiring queer artists. And I really realized quickly that like, if this was going to be a new way for the community to interact with music, it had to be representative, mm-hmm. right? This wouldn't work, at least not for me, if this was just like my 20 country buddies,
yeah.
you know, because yeah, that's yeah. like, I have 20 country buddies who are all white dudes, but that's not who my community is. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that it was, you know, diverse options as far as music went. And so that's kind of how we started building it. And then the success just kind of kept coming in and coming in, you know. Like I say, 500 plus concerts in the first year. And a slew of award nominations, right? We got nominated for 4 Western Canadian Music Awards for industry things, you know, music marketing, artist support, that kind of stuff, artist management. Awesome. Then we got Calgary Music nominations too. We just kind of kept it going, and we tried to expand it too fast because I didn't know very much about business,
yep.
you know? So I hired people in Toronto, I hired people in Vancouver yep. and like lost a shit ton of money. Mm-hmm. But then we realized that we could just trim it back and trim it back. And over the course of the first, you know, year and a half, we kind of brought it down to a small working team,
yep.
you know, that could actually handle it. We got some investment from a friend, an angel investor. And then we found ourselves starting to kind of understand the company a bit. Because at first it's a music company, but it's actually not a music company. It's a delivery company. It's a logistics and delivery company. Mm-hmm. It's like Skip the Dishes, right? There's no one cooking at Skip the Dishes head office. And there's no one playing guitar at the curbside dance. Like, it's not a music company. It's a logistics and delivery company.
Yep.
We work with contracted musicians who go to performance somewhere. And so we're an information company. But everything happens through the internet. So we're actually a technology company. And just like this constant, you know, realizing of who we are or what we are. You know, it's like looking in the mirror. Like, I know I'm a musician, but I'm also, it turns out, like a delivery and technology CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And then realizing, because Amanda owns the company, and Amanda is a citizen of Métis Nation of Alberta Region Number 3, that we're also an Indigenous-owned company. We're a female-owned company. So we're a female, Indigenous-owned tech delivery music company, you know? It's a unique space.
That may be the understatement of the month right there.
And so what we found was our first 500 gigs were at people's houses, but we also played quite well to like seniors residences and a few other communities. We started to realize that access to music was a big thing.
Mm.
That music is quite limited in its community access. If you want to go see a Matt Masters show, you have to wait till Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
You have to be able to get into a bar. You have to get up the steps. There is actually a ramp. But you have to be able to do all these things, yeah. find parking, get downtown, mm-hmm. you know, times, like all these barriers to access that exist.
Yeah.
And when we realize that if we just bring a musician to you, all these barriers don't exist anymore. Like, I might be the music fan in my house, but grandpa's not coming because he's in a wheelchair, and Junior's not coming because she's only 3 mm-hmm. or he's on whatever. But you bring the music to the neighborhood mm-hmm. and those people become audience members all of a sudden. So this isn't about competing with venues, because venues are attended by ticket buyers,
yeah.
one segment of a community.
Mm-hmm.
But curbside concerts audience was the family, very different audience.
Mm-hmm.
So we started to connect a lot with like family events, parties. And then as the reopening started happening, we found that we fit really well in public spaces like shopping malls, event or arena concourses, you know, a building, office building lobbies.
Yep.
So that's where a lot of our work is now, you know. So what the grand total is, I think it's about, we're closing in on 2,000 gigs delivered in 3.5 years.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And the idea spawned from I'm sure one of the darkest times in your life.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Like, I mean, so part of my realization in my journey was that we found out in the fall of 2020 that I have bipolar disorder. So we didn't know that. Mm-hmm. So as I was crying my eyes out in April of 2020, we didn't know that one of the struggles that I had was I have bipolar. And so I was doing some counseling already, which is how we kind of got to the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But I was really struggling, almost like to the darkest point.
Yep.
And it was a very hard time for me. And so not having a diagnosis or any medications at that point, mm-hmm. Made it way harder for all of us. And it is really crazy to think that the germination or whatever happened in that moment, mm-hmm. you know, cause I was fucking losing it. Mm-hmm. Now I'm like a lot healthier, you know, I'm medicated. I don't go to a lot of therapy now, but I've gone to good bit.
Yep.
And I'm a lot more self-aware and I have practices that I do now that I didn't used to do. So that in itself has been a journey, you know, like we could do a whole other podcast about my health.
I'm glad you bring it up. Cause it's some of those conversations that are never had.
Oh yeah, man. I hear it. Well, I talk about mental health cause I just don't care not to,
yeah.
You know, I don't have to worry about discrimination, at work around my mental health because I'm the boss.
Yeah.
And I work for myself. Well, I work for my wife, but I like a lot of people who have mental health issues struggle at work in a way that I do not. Again, like I'm a privileged person. I just got lucky in a lot of ways. But for me, I've been able to tailor my life to accommodate what I need. I need a lot of sleep. That's like that's my number one thing is rest. Mm. And so I need a job where I'm not up at the crack of dawn.
Yeah.
I need to be able to sleep till 8 o'clock or well, at least, you know, 6 o'clock if the kids are getting ready for school. Yeah, but like, yeah. You know, I need a lot of sleep. So I have to have a lifestyle that involves that. And I need to have like time for myself, mm-hmm. you know, as a guy with bipolar, I spend time thinking about stuff. And so I need to have some time to sit on the stoop and think about it. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take some hours and that's how it's going to be because mm-hmm. it's just not happening otherwise, you know, and that's how it's going to be. So you got to build like for what you need. You know, and I need time and space and I need quiet time and I need also to pay my bills, you know, but that's where we're fortunate that like curbside has connected, you know, it's become a full-time thing for both of us. And cool. Then we have two other employees, you know, so yeah, like my dad had an old saying, which was that chance favors the prepared mind. And, I think we could suggest that, you know, the lifetime of music work enabled me to see, you know, to sort of synthesize and see the possibility when everything was so dark. You know, everyone was like, shit's closing. And I was like, nothing's closing. I just need a new venue. Mm. You know, the truth is music venues like bars is a pretty dead business model.
Yeah,
like it's 100 years old. What other industry would you be like, hey, I'm starting out. I'm going to rely on this 100-year-old business model and hope for the best. Like, could you imagine if you said that in like, I don't know, transportation, mm-hmm. you know, you bring your fucking horse and buggy out, you know, but like musicians are still like, well, I think what I'm going to do is get a gig in a bar and I'll work it really hard. I'll play some more bars, then I'll get successful. And mm-hmm. it's like, it's so fucking stupid. Mm-hmm. Cause it's not how it works. You know, like hip hop didn't come from bars. Right?
Yeah.
Like punk rock did. And honky tonks really contributed to the rise of country and Western. But that was like in the 1920s, you know? And like CBGB's was in the 70s, man. Like mm-hmm. it's not a real business model. And yet so many people in the industry, okay, music, which you enjoy, the industry over here, and then live performance people. The industry wants your music to be in bars. Because it makes sense. It's part of their column. Yeah. It's one of their pillars, you know, venues, liquor sales, sponsorships. It's all part and parcel of the same thing. It all makes good sense. And to date, it's still the best business model for selling music. Do it in a bar. People will hang out, have some drinks. But it's by no means the only model. And non-traditional spaces is where everybody is.
Yeah.
Most people aren't in bars. Like if you go and survey the whole city, mm-hmm. like, I don't know, a very high percentage of people have not been to a bar this week
for sure.
And are not planning to go to a bar this week.
Yep.
So why would you only market to that percentage of people? You know, why would you only sell your product to like one tiny slice of a mm-hmm. community, you know? And then like, it's also a slice of the community that is inundated by everybody else. There's an album made every 10 seconds or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're all trying to sell to that ticket audience. These, like, how many people in Calgary? 1.23 million or
yep.
something.
Yep.
How many of them are ticket buyers? And I give names to things, music worker, ticket buyer, right? A person who goes to a concert and buys a ticket is a ticket buyer. Someone who goes to an open jam is not a ticket buyer. And nobody likes that person. I mean, bands like that person, but venue owners don't like that person, totally right? Ticket buyers. It's how the Saddle Dome runs. It's how, like, anywhere you have bumps and seats, brick and mortar, it works on this business model of ticket buyers. But what if music wasn't for sale for tickets? What if music was just valued by the community and then funded by either a patron or a fund? Mm-hmm. Sounds crazy, but this is exactly what curbside concerts is. A single client buys it. A number of people enjoy it. Like a community concert, you could easily have 40 people sitting around your cul-de-sac.
Yep.
In a shopping mall, you could easily have 2,000 people walk by in a day. So we're talking about, tens of thousands of people enjoying these concerts. Mm-hmm. But none of them had to buy a ticket. But they got to enjoy the concert. So isn't that something fucked up? Because like we're led to believe that you have to buy a ticket to enjoy music. Mm-hmm. But you don't. Mm-hmm. It's just like... tickets are the kind of parasite that has been put on the back of musicians. Mm. And most musicians will never even realize it. But I stopped playing ticketed shows a long time ago, man. Because tickets are fucking bad for the community. It's the worst, right? It's the worst. I still play ticketed shows, obviously.
Yeah.
But if I'm given the preference, I'll choose a non-ticketed show.
Yeah.
And so I just did an artist in residency thing with C Space Eau Claire. And I put on 5 concerts. And they were all ticketless. People could just come. There was funding in place by an agency that valued the work of the artists. Yeah. It was like, what are you going to do? Put on a show? Oh, these artists and people are going to see it? Oh, we value that and we will pay for that. So the audience can just enjoy it. Because you can enjoy music without being a ticket buyer. That's the thing. Music's over here. You're enjoying it over here. Ticket buying's in here. It's like a totally different beast. So like the people who think that the only music happens in venues are wrong.
Yeah.
Music happens everywhere. It's like the next innovations in music are coming from right now from people's basements, right? From people's computers and stuff.
Yeah.
Hip hop happened in the street, literally. And so putting music in a public space forces connections that wouldn't happen otherwise. You want to come and buy a Matt Masters ticket? The only people who are coming are country music fans. Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple songwriter fans, one roots guy, one dude from the blues, I don't know. But like no one from the classical community is coming. They're ticket buyers, but they're not coming to my show.
Yeah.
So if you do a community concert or a public performance, the grandpa's there who wouldn't have seen it otherwise. Oh, I never heard music like that before. Mm-hmm. That stuff's real. The kid who's like, whoa, what is that instrument? Those things don't happen in music venues to the same degree.
Yeah.
In music venue, you're like, wow, this artist is touching my heart. I'm connected with the art. I love the artist.
Yeah.
I support the artist. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to hate on music venues. I love my music venues. I've worked in them my whole life. Mm-hmm. But they're not the only place I can work.
Yeah. That you touched on it earlier. Like it's been a lifetime to get you to this moment. To understand that, to actually conceive the idea and actually however you visualize it or whatever you did to actually bring it to fruition. It's not an overnight thing. That's like it's a lifetime of experiences and pushed into a corner, come up with this crazy idea, like a very unique concept.
Pretty much,
yeah.
Pretty much, And like the things that kind of were flashing through my head, I was thinking about a delivery company. I can't remember what they're called. That worked with the grocery store, and the delivery company got most successful. It bought the grocery store. Blush Lane.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And like then whatever the delivery company they had bought the grocery store because it was like, because money's in delivery.
Yeah.
And then I was like thinking about the guys in the gold rush who made money selling shovels, because the money's in the product. Mm. The money's not in the, the money in music is not really in the music, right? It's in the industry part of it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, if I want to have income from music,
and
I'd written it down, funny enough, like a year before, start a music service company.
No way.
Yeah. Cause I understood this, I'm a 20+ year performer. I'm doing good, but I'm never gonna, actually I could retire, but I'm not going to achieve my financial goals on my music alone. Yeah. I'm just not, and I have enough experience in music business to realize there are other things out there. Mm. And lo and behold, essentially at this point we're a booking agency. you know.
Do you play any more shows in the with curbside?
Yeah, I do curbside still. You totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Awesome. Did one like a couple weeks ago. Cool. You know, and yeah, I still enjoy them. You know, I love performing. Mm-hmm. You know, I love doing a show for some people. You know, the last curbside I did was for a 6-year-old's birthday party. Like, the reason I'm not a super rock star is because I still like playing my friends' kids' birthday parties, mm-hmm. you know. And like, you know, we sang the Korn song. We did a freeze dance. You know, like, there's not a lot of entertainers who want to do that.
Yeah.
But I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's just part of what I enjoy. You know, I enjoy people. I enjoy a 1,000-person audience and I enjoy a 20-person audience. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just different. And the authenticity that you get in a small audience is like way more impactful.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I think I'll always play small shows. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just too fun not to, you know. Yeah.
So cool, man. It's been, I had no idea what to expect sitting down with you.
Oh yeah, right on.
And this is like, honestly, dude, this is, it's been one of the most refreshing, enjoyable episodes I've had in a long time. It's so fascinating.
Tell me what's fascinating about it.
Your perspective.
Yeah.
You know, the way you look at the industry, the way you look at your profession, the creativity to come up with new ideas and be innovative, like when you're pushed into a corner.
Yeah.
Your energy, your delivery, like and then to start it all off with this, like, these personal connections. You know, at the root of all of this, of how you started your thing, there's like, you know, my circle is right beside it.
Yeah, absolutely. So absolutely.
It's all of those things that give me this feeling of like, this is just a really cool, different, enjoyable conversation.
That's really cool, man. Yeah, it is. Cause we do have that, like, the fact that you live in Glendale too is pretty funny. You know, that's just like the icing on the cake there.
Totally.
But it happens like that sometimes. You know, I was riding the bus downtown number 2. And I bumped into a dude from high school on it. You know, he also lives in Glendale, mm-hmm. Andrew Gallagher. He was a good pal in high school and mm-hmm. hadn't seen him since, mm-hmm. you know. Sure enough, he has some kids. He's literally living down the street from me, you know. Yeah, like, working in music is really fun.
Yeah.
You know, that's ultimately what it comes down to. It's really fun. When it's going right, there's nothing better in the world.
Yeah.
You know, you're invited into people's most intimate moments. You know, like, you get to be part of really special things. People trust you.
Yep.
You get to speak on behalf of your community. Mm-hmm. You know, that almost to me has been some of the most impactful gigs. I did some gigs internationally for the Canadian Embassy in Turkey and in Austria, singing at the Canada Day parties for the Canadian Embassy.
Cool.
Yeah. And it is really something to, like, find yourself there in front of an audience of, like, the embassy community is full of people who are committed to their country, like, wherever they're from or whatever they do, they believe in their country.
Yeah.
And, like, we haven't really touched on my, like, life in politics yet, I have, like, a life in politics too. So I have a connection and community to, like, I have an understanding of what that national community, what my greater community is. And so to be asked to sing our national anthem in front of not just an international group, but a group of Canadians who have committed themselves to bettering the lives of our fellow citizens, to be at their embassy, is heavy. You know, like, they're trusting me to sing our song.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And, like, story and song are at the root of who we are. And to be entrusted with that responsibility gives me a unique role in the community. Mm-hmm. I am one of our record keepers. I'm one of the storytellers. I'm one of the ones who shares what it means to be Calgarian. You know, I've traveled to 30 countries. You know, I've played in 12 of them. And I've sound checked in Arabic. You know, that was a fun one. But, like, when you get further from home, you see that people like that, like these people in the embassy, I mean, are people with a passion for Canada. And that's something I appreciate. I have a passion for Canada. I have a passion for Calgary. This is my home. And I am proud of who I am, and I'm proud of where I've come from. And it's my responsibility as a musician, as an artist, to reflect my community honestly. You know, that's on me.
Yeah.
No one's gonna check me if I make up some bullshit. But I will know, and my community will know. And so it's like, that's your job as a musician, you know? And like, yeah, your job is just to make people dance, and your job is just to, you know, play your guitar. Like, it's not all too serious, but there are components of it that are extremely serious, you know? And when you're in the moment, whether it's like singing at someone's wedding or singing in front of a Saddle Dome crowd or singing in front of a 6-year-old at a birthday party, you know, like, it's serious. And if you treat it with the respect it's due, then brilliant things happen, you know? And that's where it's like, really, this is my job? I can't believe this is my job. You know, like, I just made 6-year-olds so happy by singing Moana, you know? Which is like, do I have artistic integrity? Who gives a fuck? Did I make a 6-year-old super happy? Yes. You know, did I make her grandma be like, wow, I didn't think this singer guy was going to get through 45 minutes with these kids, you know? But like that, what is music? What is music? You know, it's like, it's the sound of our community. It's what it is.
Yep.
And so if we can, you know, if we can celebrate those things, you know, that's like, that's pretty fucking special.
Yeah.
You know, and so to be able to have a job where you can be allowed to have moments like that is rare.
Yeah.
And so I recognize that. And that's why I started by saying I'm privileged, because it's really a current that runs through my life. I've been looked out for, you know, and I've had my share of struggles, you know, like, I haven't talked about alopecia. I have crazy, weird body changing disease. You know, but like, you know, you got to take what you're given and make the most of it. Yeah. And so I feel like I'm trying to, and I feel successful. I feel as though Amanda and I have, found a level of balance. You know, we still have a journey ahead of us. But compared to 4 years ago,
yeah,
we have a lot more stability,
yeah,
you know, which is something I've always really valued.
It's that chase, right? Is like as a creative looking for whatever that balance looks like. It's just, or it's more maybe security, not balance. It's more security.
Yep.
Whatever that.
Yep.
And that dance or that chase can, yep, be exhausting.
Absolutely. It's, yep, it's a constant, I think, for most people in these walks of lives, yep, you know, to find. Well, and it's also because that it goes back to some of those stereotypes about like, you can't have a regular paycheck if you ever work in music. Mm-hmm. You have to have hills and valleys, because mm-hmm, you have to live on tour, right? You have to tour, yeah, don't you?
Yeah.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
You really don't.
Holy nights, drugs, right? Like all of it.
All of it, you know? So it's a continual journey for me. You know, I feel like there's a few flags I'm always going to fly, you know, and one of them is going to be talking about music workers, because most people I meet don't understand what it means. And they don't understand, you know, there's a great music theorist named Dr. Shane Shapiro. He's a England-based Edmontonian. He's just releasing his first book, actually. But he leads a global think tank called Sound Diplomacy, which is kind of the global authority on sound or music policy. Mm. So if a city is writing a music policy, Sound Diplomacy is probably the company doing the writing. And he has some great analogies of music. You know, he talks about music like you would a piece of public grass. So it either gets ignored or it gets managed. If it gets ignored, it either dies or it overgrows. If it's managed, it's just a nice piece of grass. It's like, nice, people use it.
Yeah.
And it's like music the same way. If it's ignored, it might die or it might kind of go crazy. But if you manage it a bit, it's really enjoyable. Mm-hmm. His other great image is about, it's like a festival picture. It's like three musicians standing on a stage. A festival stage. And he says, how many jobs do you see in this picture? And most people are like, three, bass player, drummer, guitar player. But he counts them out and he's got like 35, you know,
right,
like the guy who built the stage, yeah, the person who insured the guy building the stage, you know, and he just kind of gets
into
the realities of what the industry is. The industry hasn't done a great job of selling itself as an industry,
yeah,
because in its early days, there was money to be made from the magic, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
You didn't want to know how to book your favorite band or they didn't want you to know because they wanted to be exclusive.
Yeah.
Exclusivity has been at the heart of the music industry for 100 years. I got VIP tickets. Mm-hmm. They were $150, mm-hmm. or Taylor Swift prices,
yep.
you know. It goes back to that ticket idea. You know, it's like, yeah, music can be like exclusively for the individual who has things that others don't have, mm-hmm. or music can be for a community. And that's what it's what a real music festival is like. Not to discredit festivals with yeah. ticket prices, but like when you have a festival that's a free festival and there's music, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
You know, I was at the park yesterday with my kids. We were at the Splash Park. There was a gazebo and there were two senior citizens and they were playing accordion and violin for like 2 hours straight. They were great. They were getting a little tip, you know, they were, you know, buskers, but they added so much to the experience of being at that park for two straight hours, you know? And one kid was like, that music's a bit repetitive. And I was like, well, yeah, but I mean, and they're like, yeah, no, I'm pretty happy it's here. You know, it's for old people though, Dad. Like, that's old people music. And it was pretty old person music, but it was so beautiful to have music at the park. And it's just such a simple, someone just has to value it, you know?
Yeah. Again, man, spectacular.
Thanks, man.
I end the show with one question.
Okay.
When I say Calgary, where's your head go?
Yeah, I thought about that. And I think my first word is home, because this is my home. It's my children's home. It's my wife's home. This is where my dad died. You know, this is where my mom's lived. And this is where I'm from. I think the second word for me is responsibility, because I am responsible for Calgary and the story that our future tells, mm-hmm. you know, how we treat our neighbors, how we take care of each other, how we take care of our most vulnerable community members. That's the legacy we leave. Mm-hmm. So home and responsibility, and then just to be funny, 17th Avenue.
Because
that's
back
like
to start, right?
That's like, you know, it all really does happen for me. Like within about 20 block radius of this spot, like 90% of my life has happened. Mm-hmm. So there it is: home, responsibility, and 17th Avenue.
Amazing. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is really cool to like reconnect with you. And obviously like now I understand what you have been up to instead of just seeing you in these like weird moments. Why is he, I know the guy kind of,
he's dressed up as a
like what is happening? So it was really cool.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Thank you.